Up next, New Yorker executive editor Dorothy Wickenden describes the adventures of two Smith College graduates, one of whom was her grandmother, who headed west in 1916, shocking their friends and family by teaching school in rural Colorado. I'm Julie Burstein in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC support comes from the 22nd Annual Bard Music Festival, two weekends of concerts, pre-concert talks, and other events about the musical world of composer Jean Sibelius, opening August 12th, 845-758-7900 or fishercenter.bard.edu. Lincoln Center's Mostly Mozart Festival, featuring Brooklyn's International Contemporary Ensemble in a four-part exploration of Stravinsky and Mozart on August 8th and 11th, 212-721-6500 or mostlymozart.org.
WNYC, 93.9 FM, AM 820, and WNYC.org.
No reservations are necessary for next month's Leonard Lopate Show book club when Anthony Bourdain will be our featured author. Pick up a copy of Medium Raw, his hilarious and brutally honest book, and find out why the Washington Post said anyone who starts the book is liable to lose all control and simply gobble it right up. And then tune in on Monday, August 29th, when Anthony Bourdain joins us and takes your questions. More information on the Leonard Lopate Show book club is available on our show page at WNYC.org.
I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate on this hot summer afternoon. In 1916, two graduates from Smith College, Dorothy Woodruff and Rosamond Underwood, left their families in Auburn, New York, behind and headed across the Continental Divide. They were unmarried, in their late 20s, and they had decided to take up teaching positions in a small Colorado settlement called Elkhead, far from the society luncheons and the courtships that had surrounded them at home. Nearly a century later, Dorothy Wickenden, Dorothy Woodruff's granddaughter and the executive editor of The New Yorker, found the letters that Woodruff and Underwood had sent home and began to write the story of her grandmother's adventurous life in the Colorado wilderness. Her new book, Nothing Daunted, The Unexpected Education of Two Society Girls in the West, tells the story of Dorothy and Rosamond's lives out west. The book is published by Scribner, and I'm pleased to welcome Dorothy Wickenden to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So tell me about your grandmother. Did you know this about her before you found these letters? Was this part of your family lore?
It was very much part of our family lore. My brothers and I grew up with these amazing stories of the year that she spent in Colorado with her close friend, Rosamond. And every time she visited us, she had settled in Michigan, and every time she visited us, we would beg her to tell us this, all of these stories. So they were in my mind for all these years, but it wasn't really until I found the letters so many decades later after her death that I got the idea to put it all together in a book.
It's not the experience of most people's grandmothers to do something like that.
No, it isn't. And interestingly, when I was a little girl, I just assumed that everybody's grandmother had a story like this.
I think we often do that as kids. It's like, of course, isn't everybody's father such and such?
So, yeah. And I think so when I found these letters as a middle-aged woman reading about the experiences of this extraordinary, vibrant 29-year-old woman, I just had this and I was reading them as an editor because that's how I spend my days. And I thought, wow, this woman was extraordinary and she was a wonderful writer, something she never recognized herself.
That's so interesting that you came to it now as a professional, and it sounds like you saw a story in it that was part of your family lore, but suddenly it was something bigger than that.
It was. The letters themselves, and there were 25 of them covering the course of the year that she spoke and that she taught there, and they were full scenes, basically. The dialect of the children with her exchanges in the classroom, the people they met, full descriptions of the personalities. It was just fantastic. But after I'd found the letters, I wonder if Farrington Carpenter, the young Princeton-educated lawyer who had helped his neighbors build the schoolhouse in the wilderness. I wonder if he left behind any records of the year or of his reminiscences of these two women. And he had written an autobiography called Confessions of a Maverick. And it was then, when I saw the way he had described his ideas about hiring these two Eastern cultured girls and their experience of living it, that putting them together would be both humorous and very dramatic.
And it also, it sounds like you've got that reporter's instinct for let's find another source on this to see what's happening here. I found it very interesting and powerful that here were two women who had reached the age of 29, not married, who had had fairly, for the day, independent lives. They'd lived in Europe together and they'd traveled a little bit. But this sounds like it was a step even beyond that.
It was a step way beyond. The truth is they really had led fairly conventional lives. They were unusual insofar as they had gone to a woman's college, because most women, even of their class, didn't go to college. So that was a wonderful opportunity. They did travel in Europe, like young Edith Wharton or Henry James heroines. But rather than staying in the East and settling down there, perhaps getting married or coming back to Auburn and getting married, they had a yearning to do something different. And the president of Smith College had said constantly, he'd go around the college and he would say to students, are you a leaner or a lifter? And they both didn't want to be leaners. And so when this opportunity just fell in their lap, they thought, this is what we've been waiting for.
What was the trip out there like for them?
It was an arduous trip. It was in the middle of a countrywide heat wave, and it was
familiar.
It does, yeah. And it was even hotter because they had to travel across the plains with no air conditioning, Great Plains. So they took a train from Auburn to Chicago, spent the night in Chicago, and then spent the final 3 days traveling across the Great Plains to Denver. Got up, spent the night in Grandeur at this beautiful Brown Palace Hotel. Then got up the next morning and took the brand new railroad over the Continental Divide, and that was a tiny 4-car train. So it was just, even getting out there was an adventure, and that, of course, was only the beginning.
What did they find? What were their students like when they got out there to teach?
They had decided in advance, before they left Auburn, that my grandmother would teach the younger children because she was terrible at arithmetic, as they put it, and wasn't so confident in her Latin. So they had made that decision. They split it in two. So my grandmother, and it was a huge one-room classroom, but it was divided by a folding wooden door. So my grandmother took the children who were ages 6 to 13, and Rosamond got the older children. What my grandmother didn't know is that it was going to be a classroom of all boys except for one little girl, and they were incredibly rambunctious. And she had, not only did she have no idea about how to teach, she had no idea how to discipline either. So there were many hilarious exchanges in the classroom. Difficult, but funny in retrospect.
There's a wonderful picture in the book of your grandmother up in front of the classroom with a blackboard filled with this beautiful cursive writing. And I thought, there's so much information just on that one blackboard.
I know. And I actually looked at that photo and I tried to zoom in on it once I had scanned it to see what was there. And the only thing I could really read was that it was Roy's birthday that day. It was a day in March.
So how did she learn how to deal with these boys who were living on ranches, probably, and farms?
Not even ranches, not even. They were living in one-room log cabins. They were very, very rudimentary. And she learned by trial and error. And early in the school year, they were visited by an experienced teacher who took her aside and said, you really need to learn how to discipline these boys. And she didn't want to exert her physical discipline, but she did resort to it a couple of times with great reservations and anxiety. And she loved the little boys. So she would take one into the supply closet to discipline him. He'd burst into tears, and then she couldn't even bear to bring herself to discipline him. She'd give him a sweater instead. And then she said the tears were pouring down his face, but he was wreathed in smiles, you know, and as he walked out with his new sweater on. A sweater which, by the way, had been sent from Auburn as part of these shipments that then began to arrive periodically from their families and friends in Auburn.
Now, Farrington Carpenter plays quite a role in here. And by bringing out teachers, it wasn't just teachers he was looking for. It was women, too, because they were very rare out in these parts.
Well, and it wasn't just women. It was young, college-educated women who were good-looking, and that was a very important part of it. Rosamond and Dorothy, of course, had no idea that this was actually a scheme, a two-part scheme. They went out with these great ideals about discovering the American West and teaching these benighted children, all of which they did. So that was Carpenter was completely clear about that. What he didn't tell them, though, was that he was one of these lonely cowboys, and they desperately wanted brides. And in later years, he talked about this all the time, very openly and extremely humorously.
And in fact, there was a bit of, I wouldn't say a tussle, but as they arrived, he and another man were really on the lookout for, okay, who's who and what do they look like?
Well, and that's one of the most interesting parts of it's incredible that all of this just turned out to be a natural great story. He and his best friend, Bob Perry, whose father was one of the great industrialists of Denver, were competing immediately for Rosamond's affections. They both just fell in love with her. She was beautiful and willowy and gentle, exactly what they had hoped for. And they were the two college-educated men in the area, and they became very friendly with both Dorothy and Roz, and they made every weekend, basically, they came to visit. And so they were best friends. So it was this gentlemanly rivalry, but they were dead serious about each one of them, about trying to get her. And part of the drama in the book is seeing how all that works out.
I'm speaking to Dorothy Wickenden about her new book, Nothing Daunted, The Unexpected Education of Two Society Girls in the West, and it's from Scribner. Now, Bob Perry figures in another very dramatic story. Can you tell us about what happened to him?
He does, and this was only several months after they had gotten out there. And they got a call from Ferry Carpenter one day at the schoolhouse. There was no phone at the house. And he said that they'd planned to take an excursion because it was Rosamond's birthday. And he said, I'm afraid Bob isn't feeling very well, and so we'll have to postpone this. Well, as they later discovered, Bob had been kidnapped by two Greek miners who had worked in his father's mine, the mine that he oversaw, and taken him up into the hills at gunpoint. And this went on for several days, and it became a huge story, as I later discovered, in newspapers from Chicago to Los Angeles. So there's a whole chapter devoted to the kidnapping. I was able to reconstruct that with contemporaneous accounts and with court documents.
Did your grandmother tell you stories about that?
She did, and I talked to my brothers a little bit about that, too. And it's interesting, you remember different things. And so my younger brother said she even acted it out. She'd play the bandit and he did have a handkerchief around his face and so on. And I read in her letters about the kidnapping, I thought, I wonder if it was as dramatic as she made it out to be when she was telling us the stories. And in fact, as I discovered, it was even more dramatic with two rifles and one, a handgun and so on.
You know, as I read the book, I thought you have a wonderful story here and you have the complicated piece of writing about something that's already happened and that there's all this suspense and there is that part of that suspense of who's going to get the girl, which is a part of it, and what's going to happen with this kidnapping. How did you think about writing this story, telling a story where the end, here you are, you're the granddaughter, so you know that your grandmother met someone and although you don't know where and who. But as a writer, what did you think about when you thought, how do I tell this story for people who are not in my family?
I really started out with the letters, and the book began with a piece for the New Yorker, and it was just centered on that single year. The book expands a great deal and
yes,
talks a lot more about their trip to Europe, based on other letters I had found, and I wanted it to be absolutely factual. And I wanted to have enough distance from her that it wasn't going to be a sentimental account just about my grandmother and her best friend experiencing this thing. So I just – and then I sort of would pick up little tips in her letter. So, for instance, or her oral history. So in her oral history, she had mentioned going back to Auburn, which is where she grew up, which is a big industrial city, very, very wealthy. She just mentioned offhand, my grandfather lived next door to William Seward, who was Lincoln's Secretary of State,
yes,
among many other fine qualities. And so I thought, well, I wonder if that's true. And I went to Auburn and I went to the Seward house and the executive director said, yes, indeed, Mr. Woodruff lived right there next and pointed out Seward's library window. So through these wonderful little tips and in Rosamond's letters too, I began to pull it all together. And I also became very interested in the history of these little towns in the West, most of which have now vanished.
Did you travel out there to look at
them? I did, several times.
Had you been there before, or was this the first time you had done that exploring?
When I was 18, thanks to my grandmother, I actually worked on the ranch that was owned by Rosamond's granddaughter. So my grandmother was Dorothy, her grandmother was Rosamond. And so I worked at her, took care of, I was basically an au pair and took care of her children on her ranch in Carbondale, Colorado. And then at the end of the summer, she said we should go see Ferry and well, I won't give it away, but we should go see Ferry Carpenter. And we did. And I was 18. Ferry was 87. And he lived outside. He lived in a little outside Hayden on this gigantic ranch, which he had acquired over the years. And he took me all the way up to Elkhead, which was a very bumpy ride. And he drove at the age of 87 this old, you know, rickety truck. And he told me the story. And so I think that had sort of settled into my imagination, too. And I wanted to get back to that as well.
How did this adventure affect your grandmother's life? Did it change her?
It changed her remarkably, and she was the first to admit that. And Rosamond said the same thing, as I discovered later when I interviewed some of Rosamond's descendants. You can see it, even in the course of the 9 months they were there, how they were being changed, how rapidly they were being changed by, mostly, I would say, by the pioneer women they met. And it sounds like a cliche, but these women were so stoic, so self-contained, so able to do every task that was set before them, and good-humored about it, too. My grandmother and Rosamond just thought they were absolutely extraordinary. They were doing things that they could never have imagined. And so later in life, both Rosamond and Dorothy had pretty serious tragedies befall them. And I don't know how they would have resolved them if they hadn't had this experience in Elkhead and been able to draw on the experiences of these women as role models. And as my grandmother's older daughter, Caroline, said, she said, you know, my mother just took life by the throat, took life by the throat and grabbed it and dealt with it.
And how do you think it affected you, this kind of history that came down to you as a woman growing up in the later part of the 20th century rather than the late 19th and the early part of the 20th
century? I've thought about that a lot in after having written the book. And I have known for many years that I was interested in American history, but I had never really thought that my grandmother was probably responsible for that interest. And I grew up in the second wave of feminism. She, of course, grew up during the first wave of feminism, and that's part of the book, too, because Auburn was a bastion of early feminists. So for me, it was a voyage of self-discovery, in part, and it was also an incredibly wonderful opportunity to vicariously live this adventure that the two of them had taken on.
How about in your parents' generation? Did you find that Dorothy's adventures affected her children as well?
Very much. And of course, they grew up, she had four children, and they grew up with these stories as well. They reacted in different ways. I would say my Caroline, whom I just mentioned, her older daughter was probably the most like her. Very, you know, went off to work for the Red Cross during World War II. She went out west after she graduated from Smith as well. So there were a lot of, and I see a lot of my grandmother in her now that she's a 90-year-old woman.
When you were doing the research for this, was there something you came upon that startled you that you thought, I hadn't expected this to be part of this story?
There were many, many of those moments, but maybe one of the most, and to me it was one of the most touching, was to see the diversity of the homesteaders. It's sort of what, because you think about homesteaders having been drawn elsewhere from the West and the Midwest and so on. Well, one of the homesteaders who became a good friend of theirs, who lived just south of the school, was a white Russian Jew who uneducated, who had come over to America by steerage, and he had traveled all around Europe, and he'd stopped at a library everywhere he went, and he'd read about the American West and dreamed of becoming a rancher. And so, and I was able to piece all this together later on, and he ended up in Elkhead. And his story, which then goes on after the year they were there, it ends up becoming this amazing mythic kind of experience of becoming a successful immigrant in America.
Well, it was lovely to read your grandmother's story and beyond that, really a sense of the West opening up through the story of your grandmother, Dorothy and Rosamond.
Well, that's great. That's what I hoped would happen.
I am speaking with Dorothy Wickenden, and she is talking about her new book, Nothing Daunted, Unexpected Education of Two Society Girls in the West, and it's from Scribner. Thank you so much.
Thank you.